Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And as that music by Cormasan, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, courtesy of James Corbett et al., gradually fades out, and more about that later. Welcome to TMR number 272, in which we are taking a welcome break from all things Rona for another of our movie roundtable sessions here at The Mind Renewed, as we continue to discuss films that have some relevance to the themes explored on the show over the last almost 9 years. And this is number 10 in the series. We're going to be chatting about the 1978 conspiracy thriller comedy movie, Capricorn One, starring Elliot Gould, James Brolin, Sam Waterston, O.J. Simpson, of all people, and the rather excellent pair, in my view, Brenda Vaccaro, I don't know how you pronounce that, and Hal Holbrook. And as I said last time, I might stop listing the films once we've got so far as to go past 10 films. So as we haven't quite got there yet, I shall list them off one last time. We have so far chatted about The Brotherhood of the Bell, Batman the Movie, 12 Monkeys, The Illustrated Man, Silent Running, The Insider, The Shout, Groundhog Day, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and now Capricorn One, for which we are joined by our faithful and wise film critics Frank Johnson in sunny California, Mark Campbell in, well, Crayford, yeah, and Anthony Rotuno in some undisclosed location in the UK. Now he's not in Spain. Gentlemen, welcome back to the TMR Movie Roundtable.
Hello.
Thank you.
Nice to be here again.
Oh, well, thanks very much for coming on to have this number 10 discussion. Just before we carry on, I just want to say that the music was, as I say, by the group Cormasan, which involves the one and only James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. And the song is Crabs Up North. As I have to say now, living up north, I have to say Crabs Up North. And it was part of their 2021 album called Capricorn One. So how about that? Thank you, Anthony, for that tip. And that song specifically references the film, and I'll just quote from the lyrics here. A wannabe pirate with a wooden sword. Stanley Kubrick's looking pretty bored. Wires and hairspray and make pretend Capricorn One was a big fat clue. So we'll play that at the end of the show. So thank you, James, for allowing us to use that music. So... Anthony, how are you doing at the moment? You've got loads of podcasts going still, and you've chatted to, well, James Corbett a number of times recently, haven't you?
Yeah, just going to say, James will definitely be listening to this, so hi to him. We just reviewed the US versus John Lennon, which was a documentary about John Lennon's fight to stay in the USA, but we got into lots of good stuff about 70s politics. Oh. Not a million miles from what we're talking about today, of course.
Yes, true.
And yeah, podcasting like a demon, and yeah, nice to be back.
Excellent. And you had a very interesting conversation with, is it Doug Valentine, a few months back? That was really interesting.
Yeah, amazing. The only slight trouble we had is that he's hard of hearing and he was using the Skype subtitles. So I managed to cobble it all together. And he wrote a book called The CIA is Organized Crime, and it's fantastic. Right. And he wrote one about Vietnam called The Phoenix Program.
Yeah.
Anyone who is interested in the Vietnam War, they may well not know about this CIA program called The Phoenix Program. So yeah, it was great to talk to him.
Yeah, it was a very interesting discussion. I shall, of course, stick a note in the show notes so people can go straight to that and listen to that. Frank, how are you doing? Have you been to the jump room yet? Because we're talking about Mars today. The Mars jump room, have you been there yet?
Well, I can't either confirm or deny that, but everything else is going fine.
The reason why I mentioned that is because Johnny McMahon mentioned about the Mars jump room, which I think is there in somewhere in California, isn't it?
Yeah, he said it's like up in Manhattan Beach or somewhere, or maybe up by Venice Beach. I forget which one it is now.
Yeah.
But he said that William Ramsey claims that they have this room up there, and that's where they teleport to Mars.
Yes, it sounds excellent, and I'm hoping that we're going to be able to talk about that at the New Year show in some detail.
Yeah.
Mark, how are you? How is everything over at Dunyandlin?
Oh, thank you. Yes. No, it's good. It's fine, I think. Mm-hmm. Yes. I have actually been to Mars, talking about that. when I went to Florida to Disney, uh-huh. They had a Mission to Mars ride, and it's basically a vast centrifuge. So warnings all over the place about, you know, you can't do it if you're pregnant or you've got back problems, etc., etc., etc. So it's quite sort of off-putting.
Mm.
And I did it. You go into this enclosed cockpit and you're supposed to be controlling it, taking off and landing, and you feel the gravity pushing on you, which is the centrifuge as it goes around.
Right.
And I came out of it. I thought, well, that was quite fun. I'll do it again. And basically, for the rest of the holiday, I was nauseous for literally 2 weeks. It was awful. It was actually really, oh, it was really bad.
I've been to the Mars factory, true story, because it's quite near to where I grew up.
Oh, excellent.
It was lovely for a while, like the smell of the chocolates, obviously. Yeah. I was thinking, blimey, I'm going to be a chocolate addict. But then after about half an hour, I was thinking, not sure if I want to working here all day. Sort of sickly after a while, but yeah. Anyway,
nausea is a sort of common theme there. Anything to do with Mars.
Yes. There you go.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about any personal takes that we have on this particular film. I mean, I remember watching it back in, I think it must be the early 80s, and I was really intrigued by it. I remember first seeing it with my dad. Now, he'd seen TV coverage, well, of what was purported to be TV coverage of the first moon landing in 1969 and had stayed up all night with it to see this. That was a big thing for him, so he really enjoyed this film, just the very notion of a hoaxing of such a thing. I don't think he ever had doubts that it really happened, but I remember watching it with him, and I enjoyed the vibes I was getting off him that he was enjoying it too, you know. And since then, I think it's been one of my favourite films, actually. In spite of its many shortcomings, which no doubt we will talk about, what about you, Mark? Any history with this film?
Yeah, well, I think I probably saw it about the same time as you, because I've kept a diary for years and years and years, and I just looked up now. Saturday the 16th of January 1982, watched Capricorn 1 on ITV, a very exciting, if flawed, film by Lou Grade, no less. Mm. Nothing else of interest happened. That's my entry for the day.
Nothing else of interest in your life happened that day. Is that what that means?
Ever again.
Yes. Yes.
Until now.
Until now. So I was 14, so that's the first time I saw it. I think I've probably seen it a couple of times, and then again for this podcast, so perhaps 3 or 4 times and all. Mm. And on my finish. It probably hasn't changed. It's a good film, but if a bit flawed.
Frank, any history with this film?
I do have some, actually, because how I got into this film was, I think in the early 2000s, I had read or had seen part of the Richard Hoagland's moon hoax stuff, and he had mentioned this movie in his book, and so I'm like, oh, I'll go check it out. And then I actually rented the film from the local library, and I started watching it, and I got up to the part where he I forget the character's name, but he comes into them when they're about to launch and he gives them his little spiel he does that starts the movie off.
Oh, yeah.
And after that, I didn't really watch the movie after that. And then I obviously watched the whole thing for this podcast, but I'm like, man, I wish I would have finished that movie back then. So I started it and gave it up just because I'm like, well, I don't get what they're trying to do with this. And I had other movies to watch. I'm like, well, we'll move on.
So you took it rather literally when Brubaker said, hey, what's going on? You thought, yeah, what's going on?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, what's going on? And then I'm like, we won't find out.
Well, I'm glad you've enjoyed it since anyway. Anthony, now you were particularly keen on doing this one, weren't you?
Yeah. The first time I remember watching it was probably only about 10 years ago. And I've seen it maybe 4 times now. I watched it yesterday. It's very enjoyable. I mean, I just loved it. To some people, a film, the number one thing for a film is to entertain. So I'd give this very high marks for entertainment. Obviously, you can pick holes in it, but I think it just brings up loads and loads of interesting questions as well. I don't really see it as trying to justify the idea that the moon landings were fake necessarily, but just the idea that you might be able to have a conspiracy that not that many people would know about. I think that's the theme that attracts me. But yeah, just really entertaining. I've completely forgotten about Telly Savalas. I thought he was brilliant.
He was. Yeah, I agree. It doesn't really give weight to the idea of the moon landings being hoax, does it? But nevertheless, I suppose it did help to inspire that thought in people around the time, I should think, and ever since. But yeah, I think it's fantastic entertainment, as you say, and full of interesting ideas that we're going to discuss. So I'm going to do a brief synopsis for people. Well, I always say it's brief. It's not brief. It's going to be quite long. But for anybody who has not seen it or hasn't seen it for ages, so here we go, as quickly as I can here. After some arresting music, followed by a black screen that eventually gives way to sunrise, revealing launch pad and rocket, we enter the story of the first manned or first personed mission to Mars. Three NASA astronauts, Colonel Charles Brubaker, played by James Brolin, Lieutenant, depending on which side of the pond you live, Colonel Peter Willis, played by Sam Waterston, and Commander John Walker, played by, of all people, O.J. Simpson, take their positions in the spaceship, only to be ushered out almost immediately by a nameless suit and unceremoniously flown to a distant base in the desert while the blast-off goes ahead without them. Thereafter, at the base, the three are treated to a stilted speech by Mission Scientific Director Dr. James Kellaway, played by Hal Holbrook, who explains to them the change of plan. 2 months prior to the launch, it was discovered that their onboard life support system had turned out to be faulty. Had they flown, they would all now be dead. And given that there was no longer a mood in Washington for any failure of the hugely expensive space program, it was decided by the powers that should not be that the mission should go ahead anyway without them as a faked Mars landing. Naturally, the astronauts would need to play their part, acting as if they were journeying through space and landing on the Martian surface, all from the TV studio in the desert, of course. Understandably, the three are not chuffed by this prospect and of having to lie to the world, and they seek to distance themselves from the idea until, under pressure from the said powers that should not be, Dr. Kellaway is forced to threaten their wives and children. "You have to help," he insists, and reluctantly, they do help. But not all goes well with the conspiracy. A data analyst at Mission Control notices anomalies in the flight data. The wife of Colonel Brubaker, Kay, receives a weird cryptic message from her husband that she doesn't understand. And a news reporter, Robert Caulfield, played by Elliot Gould, begins to pick up on the mounting strange occurrences, such as the disappearance of his friend, the data analyst who suddenly seems never to have existed. His car that gets fixed up for an accident, a bullet that almost hits him, and some cocaine that a bunch of supposed FBI men plant in his apartment. Going further and further down this uncomfortable rabbit hole, crucially, Caulfield picks up on Kay Brubaker's confused reaction to her husband's cryptic message. Her family had not gone to Yosemite on vacation last summer, as Brubaker said in the communication. They had gone to Flat Rock, where a Western was being filmed, a technological feat that had so impressed Brubaker that Kay remarks, "He couldn't get over how something so fake could look so real." He kept on saying, "With that kind of technology, you could convince people of almost anything." So now, smelling the full whiff of the proverbial rat, Caulfield rather too quickly identifies the location of the desert base with the help of his lady friend, and there finds incontrovertible evidence that the Mars landing had been faked at the desert TV studio. Meanwhile, the mission and its deception seem to be going well for the powers that should not be, but for a sudden heat shield failure as a space capsule re-enters the Earth's atmosphere, at which point the mission is forced to change. The three astronauts can no longer play their parts. At the ocean drop zone, they are now dead men. Their existence does not fit the new narrative, and they realize they have to escape, and so they do, with the help of the plane that took them there, which hasn't got enough fuel, so now they're forced to land in the thirsty desert, and they are obliged to trudge through the wilderness, pursued by archetypal black helicopters as they try to reach civilization and tell their story. In the end, only one of them makes it, Colonel Charles Brubaker, thanks to some unexpected help from an amusingly offensive Telly Savalas in a crop-dusting plane. And thus the film reaches its conclusion as we watch Brubaker with Caulfield at his side, running in slow motion, as we all did in 1970s, towards his own memorial service, much to the astonishment of the mournful congregation, including his wife, his children, Dr. Kellaway, the President of the United States, and a clutch of primetime TV cameras, all ready and willing to disclose the now-failed conspiracy to the watching world. And then we end with some arresting music. So that's it. As I say, quite a long one.
I just want to make one comment.
Yeah, sure. I missed something, did I, Anthony?
Well, I was thinking this would obviously be classed with, like I said, conspiracy thrillers like All the President's Men and so forth. Mm. But there's one sort of disaster movie reference, which is that one of the reasons why the mission wouldn't have worked was that they were skimping on the costs of it, which kind of reminded me of Towering Inferno.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's got one foot in the sort of disaster movie as well, isn't it? Mm. So.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. So this was written and directed by Peter Hyams. Does anybody know much about him?
Nope.
the thing about he worked on the CBS broadcast of the Apollo. Was it Apollo 11 or one of the moon landings?
Oh,
yeah. I think it might have been Apollo 11.
I think it might have been. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And the quote that he came up with was an event of huge importance that had no witnesses. Mm. And then he said, I grew up in the generation when my parents basically believed what they read in the newspapers and then later on the television. Mm. I don't think he thought they were fake, but obviously that gave him a bit of inspiration. And another interesting thing is that apparently audiences in the cinema at one point stood up and cheered. Again, not that they thought that the moon landings were fake, but it struck a certain chord.
Mm.
Because something James Corbett and I were talking about is that they always call this the paranoia era, but we would argue it's perhaps more the realistic era. It was an era that I would have quite liked to have lived through, to be honest, where questioning the government was really at its height, I think.
Yeah, well, it was Watergate, of course, made this believable, made it marketable, didn't it? That must have had a big influence. I think that was mentioned at some point.
Yes, I think Elliot Gould is mentioned in relation to the journalists on that, doesn't he? Mm.
Yeah, that wonderfully cynical boss.
Yeah. Says, oh, you'll know, whatever their names are, you'll know.
Oh, that's right, yes.
I like the bit where he says, you're fired. Oh, that sounds so good. Let me say that again.
Yeah, you're fired. Yeah. He's brilliant, isn't he? It's brilliant.
Yeah, they're quoting movie lines to each other. Brilliant stuff, yeah. Loads of good comedy in this.
Oh, yeah, it is, yeah. Some good character stuff, isn't it? Yeah.
Mm. So that's David Doyle. I didn't know the name before. I recognise the face.
Charlie's Angels.
Ah, that's it.
He's the boss in Charlie's Angels, isn't he?
He reminded me a bit of Jack Lemmon, that style. A bit more manic, than even Jack Lemmon.
Yes.
Very good.
Yeah.
And one thing about Elliot Gould, I think, he seems to have good chemistry with lots of different people, like the Karen Black character,
mm-hmm.
and then the boss, and then even Telly Savalas. Elliot Gould's kind of a bit cynical, but likeable. He's not sleazy.
Yeah, well, Elliot Gould had played Philip Marlowe a few years earlier in The Long Goodbye, 1973. And I saw that recently. I hadn't seen it before. And he sort of played almost the same character, but a bit lighter in this, a little bit more comic, of course, in this one.
But doesn't Elliot Gould always play Elliot Gould? I mean, has he done anything other than that sort of shtick?
I don't know, but I get that impression. Yeah, yeah. Just slight variations on himself.
Yes.
Yeah. I didn't think he was convincing as Marlowe, actually, in The Long Goodbye. I didn't think that interpretation worked.
No.
But I think this did, because I think he does bring that. Mm. He's able to play seriously and gently comically almost at the same time.
Mm.
He functions to bring the drama and the comedy together. You know, without him, I don't think this film would have worked, actually.
Mm.
Trying to stitch those two elements together, I think, would have failed miserably. But I think, you know, he facilitated that.
Mm.
What do you think?
Just saying Peter Hyams. Mm. I mean, I've seen Outland, which he did with Sean Connery, which is sort of High Noon in space.
Oh, yeah.
Which I enjoy. I think it's a good film. And he did 2010, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
The dreadful sequel to the film that doesn't need a sequel.
I didn't enjoy that either. That was with Roy Scheider, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Mm.
I have a feeling we saw it together, Julian.
Was it? Yeah. I was disappointed by it.
I think we were both pretty disappointed by it. I think we had the idea that at the end of it, the whole revelation would be Arthur C. Clarke coming out and saying, buy the book. The end of the film.
Right. I seem to remember being disappointed by some sort of explanation of the black monolith, you know? Mm. It shouldn't have any explanation.
No. I mean, it wasn't his... He didn't... Obviously, that's Arthur C. Clarke who wrote the book and the sequel, but that's another of his films. I mean, he's a good filmmaker, I think.
And then this was produced by Lou Grade's ITC, Incorporated Television Company, which has got a whole load of great entertainment in its portfolio, hasn't it? The Saint with Roger Moore, Danger Man and The Prisoner with Patrick McGoohan, Thunderbirds, The Muppet Show, Jesus of Nazareth, and some films, Boys from Brazil, which I think is another excellent film, The Return of the Pink Panther.
Yeah.
And
you got all the Beatles songs as well.
Ah.
My Glass Onion listeners will get upset if I don't mention the Beatles. So there you go. Yeah, he scooped up all the Beatles songs before Michael Jackson bought them off him. So anyway.
He also did Raise the Titanic, if you've seen that.
Oh, yeah.
I remember that, actually. Yeah. There's a quote from him, I'm sure it said something like, it would have been cheaper to have lowered the Atlantic or something. Because it did terrible. I mean, it bombed absolutely, well, sank. As it
were. And I found a great little anecdote here about Hyams and Lazarus, the producer, approaching Grade about this because they're having difficulty getting anybody interested in this. Well, it says that that's Hyams Lazarus, rang the bell at Grade's hotel Sunday morning, 9 a.m., and he opens the door, standing there in his silk bathrobe with the whitest legs I've ever seen in my life and this enormous Churchill cigar in his mouth. And he said, "Hello, boys. You're the people with the Mars shot?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Wonderful. You have a deal. Thank you for coming in." Brilliant. We walked out and Peter said, "What does that mean?" I said, "I don't have the foggiest idea. We flew 3,000 miles for a one-sentence meeting." So just like that, he accepted it. So,
was that his first cigar of the day?
Yeah. But he was famous for that, wasn't he? He was absolutely famous for that. I love that about him. He just said, "Yeah, that sounds good. Here's the money. Go make it." Wonderful.
Just go with his gut feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, and often it was right. You know, let's face it.
And the music by the brilliant Jerry Goldsmith, of course, which we'll talk about in a bit. I didn't find any nude swimming, though. Did any of you find any?
No, disappointing.
No, I didn't see it either. I was looking for it the whole time, and I'm like, no.
Because Elliot Gould does end up in the river, doesn't he? But he's got clothes on, unfortunately.
Yes.
That was clothes swimming, yes.
Oh, dear.
Perhaps his clothes came off in the car and then he put them on again.
That must be what it is, because we're talking about it, aren't we?
Yes.
All right.
He must be in the director's cut somewhere.
Yeah, he hit the water with such force his clothes would have been ripped off him and he must have put them on. Back on.
It's got to be in the deleted scenes on the DVD somewhere.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Okay, well, we talked about Elliot Gould. What about some of the other people then? James Brolin as Colonel Charles Brubaker. What do we reckon?
Pretty good. Does his part well. He reminded me a lot of Lee Majors in the $6 Million Man, actually. I mean, not much of a part, really, is it? But it's okay.
He seemed to play the same character as he did in Westworld.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a nod to Westworld, of course, isn't there? Very obvious one, yeah. The Western set,
Yeah, I thought that, actually, when I saw it. I hadn't tweaked it before, but yeah.
Right.
I don't think there's any deep characters in this film. I think he just he did a fine job. He was believable enough. I can kind of divorce, when I watch OJ or something like that, I can kind of divorce it from what happened in real life. But honestly, I think he was very wooden anyway. The other astronaut was quite good, I think. He didn't have
Sam Waterston, is that right?
Sam Waterston, that's
it. No, he was good. He got some good lines. He was very sort of laconic, wasn't he? Some witty. Some of his one-liners are very good at sort of just lightening the tone, as it were. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he had that really excellent line, didn't a funny thing happened on the way to Mars when he's talking to Dr. Kellaway, which I presume is a reference to the book, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon, which is a collection of anecdotes to do with the space race.
Can I mention a couple of the lines? I don't know who delivered them, but $4 billion to put crazy people into space.
Yes.
And when they're in the studio, and I think it's Brubaker says, "Are you hungry?" And someone says, "Here we are, millions of miles from Earth, and we can still send out for pizza."
Yeah.
And then I think it is Sam Waterston, when they're all supposed to be dead, he says, "Ah, shame, I was a terrific guy."
Yes, that's him. Yes. They're almost like ad libs, aren't they? They're almost, I mean, I'm sure they're all scripted, but they come across as being kind of ad libs, which is very good.
Yeah.
There's another one I thought was good where they're just about to be pulled out of the spaceship right at the beginning. And Brubaker says, "You know, if you want to leave now, now's the chance." You know, then it happens. What about, I don't know how to pronounce her name, but Brenda Vaccaro? I have to say, I think she was probably the best of all the actors. I was very impressed with that.
Right.
So this is Kay Brubaker, the wife. She had to do more acting, I think, than anybody else.
Yeah, I mean, she doesn't go for the obvious, does she? Mm. She doesn't go for the obviously upset all the time, which I like.
Mm.
And I like that scene with her and Elliot Gould, where Elliot's sort of saying, you know, tell me more about this particular thing that he said to you.
Yes.
I'm not doing it for any... They go around the houses a little bit. He says, I'm not doing it to write about it. It's personal. And it's a very believable scene between those two. And then they kind of sort of get their defences down slightly and open up with each other.
Mm.
And I think he plays it quite straight, doesn't he, in that scene?
He does. And actually, I think that was well scripted as well as acted, that
yes.
bit. Where I think the script falls down, at certain times, other characters take on a similarity of style to the Elliot Gould character, just in order to facilitate the humour with him sort of listing things in a sarcastic way. Kay does that at one point, and the girlfriend of the Elliot Gould character does that as well later on. I thought that was a bit of a drop in the believability of the script there, but just a small point.
No, I don't know. I think the chemistry between, was it Karen Black, the woman
Karen Black, yeah.
I mean, all that business about I'm going to jump you and all that stuff. I remember when I watched that and I didn't know what that meant. What does that mean? I didn't know what they were talking about. I quite like that she's as sort of wisecracking as he is. I think they suit each other.
I love the cynicism of that whole world around journalism. I'm sure we'll talk about the scene there with the car.
Oh, yeah.
But like, he just gets zero sympathy from anyone.
Yeah.
He gets shot at, they plant cocaine, tamper with the brakes in his car. His boss just couldn't care less. And she doesn't have any
sympathy. His boss says to him straight, I don't like you.
Yeah.
It's an excellent way to talk to somebody when you bring them into the office. What about Hal Holbrook, Dr. James Kellaway?
Superb.
I think he's great. Yeah, brilliant.
Yeah.
Very, very believable.
Yeah. I wasn't sure, you know, this must go back to the early days when I saw it, is he gives a speech, doesn't he? And you've got the three astronauts there in the base, and he comes in to explain what's going on.
Mm.
And I thought, I think it must be the first time I saw it. I thought, that sounds so stilted and contrived. But then, you know, since then I've thought, yeah, he's prepared that speech, and he's in a very difficult situation. So, of course, he's just delivering what he's already prepared, trying to be natural, but he can't help being uncomfortable at the same time. So actually, I think he did that incredibly well.
Yeah, because the idea really is that obviously he's a human being, and I think he maybe does feel a bit guilty about it.
Yeah.
But he represents the faceless corporation that doesn't care. You know, maybe the people that work for it does, but the corporation, high-end capitalism, doesn't care. So him being a little bit machine-like is almost better. Yeah, you're right.
I think he's really good at playing that sort of morally compromised, accomplished person. You know, same sort of thing he did in The Firm, you know, somebody who's sold out to the devil kind of thing. But inside he wants to be good, really, but he can't afford to be anymore, that sort of thing. He's really good at that.
He's in one of my favourite films, The Fog, John Carpenter's The Fog.
Oh,
and he's the priest of the small town. He discovers a terrible secret that the whole foundation of the town is based on. And again, he's playing the same sort of character, you know, a figure of authority, but carrying this sort of burden, this secret. He's a very, very good actor, isn't he? Very watchable.
Yes.
There's a brilliant bit where there's a press conference and he's sort of talking about how the astronauts have supposedly been killed in the Capricorn 1. And he's sort of reading and he gets a word wrong, a contract instead of contact.
That's it. Yeah.
And then corrects himself and carries on. Now, whether that was deliberate or not, I don't know. But it just adds a huge amount of realism to him as a character in that whole scene. It's brilliant. If it was a mistake, well done that they kept it in.
Yeah,
absolutely. I noticed that as well, and I thought exactly the same thing. I suspect it was a mistake and kept him, but you know, you can't prove it, can you? Yeah.
Yeah.
It felt like that.
It's believable, isn't it? Because people never do in films, whenever they talk to each other, nobody ever corrects themselves because they get a word wrong. It's so realistic. Yeah. So to do that is brilliant.
They do that even less now, wouldn't they, nowadays?
Oh, yeah.
Everything's got to be slick and... Yeah,
absolutely.
Did he ever star in anything? Because he seems like the ultimate sort of reliable supporting character actor, isn't he? You know he's going to always do a good job. Did he ever actually star in anything?
Don't know.
I feel like he didn't.
Don't know. I mean, I'm quite open not to star in something, just because somehow it would be less interesting if he comes in as these excellent supporting characters and gives life to the film. I think that's pretty good.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
Okay, we've mentioned David Doyle. What about Telly Savalas then? Do you think it was a good idea to stick him in the movie?
Why not?
Brilliant.
Frank, are you a Kojak fan?
I didn't even realize it was him because I knew you had said he was in the movie, but I couldn't quite pick out who he was because I couldn't quite remember what he looked like. But then I think you had mentioned he played the pilot, and I'm like, oh, yeah. I thought that was probably my favorite performance of the movie. He was just very lippy, and he found out like he worked for the press or whatever, and he charged him more money. It's just his attitude and demeanor was delightful for me.
I loved all that stuff where he said, "Oh, it's $25." He says it's $100. And then he agrees to $100. He says $125 because you agree to $100.
Great
stuff. It's brilliant.
It's great that he keeps on calling him a pervert as well, and doesn't seem to be any no reason for it. It's just offensive, and yet you sort of can't take offence. You know, if I was Caulfield there, I don't think I'd take offence because he's just so jolly about it somehow. It's weird.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Oh dear. I actually thought that David Huddleston was really good as the congressman, Hollis Peaker. That really condescending manner. The big guy with the glasses was so condescending, but in a nice way. I really thought that was excellent. I can imagine people like that being US Congress people, or just politicians generally.
I mean, that's probably a bit more realistic. That's probably a bit more realistic, isn't it? But how they probably actually talk to each other, or talk about each other, I should say.
Yeah.
It's very well cast, isn't it? The film is very well cast. Mm.
Mm-hmm. It is.
One has to say, no, these are all people you expect to behave like they do, and they do. There's no one you could that says, "Oh, I don't believe that this person would be in this position."
Except perhaps OJ.
Well, is that only in light of what we know about him?
I don't know.
He really didn't do much in the movie. But if you've ever wanted to see OJ Simpson give a funny performance, he was in I think he was in at least two of the three Naked Gun movies. He might have been in all three.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I remember watching the first one recently, and it made me laugh quite a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but his woodenness just makes Leslie Nielsen funny, I think. You know? honestly, it's nothing to do with the real events, but he's wooden in everything I've seen him in.
Yeah.
But maybe that's what you needed for this part. You don't really need much of a character, do you? And I was thinking that maybe if you had somebody like Sidney Poitier or something, a real, you know, real talent, that would have been a disaster anyway, wouldn't it? Because, you know, somebody like that just to do very little.
Yeah. Alan Fudge.
Oh, which was that? Was that the guy with the Bible?
No, he's the capsule coordinator, kind of bald guy. Oh. And I just like the name, Alan Fudge, but
I love the voice as well. Did he do the voice of the NASA controller? Is that his voice?
Yeah, I think he's the first voice you hear, I think, as you say, when the screen starts black and you're talking about what they had for breakfast and et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, yeah.
Capricorn 1.
It's a great way to start the movie, isn't it, really?
Very good. Really good.
And what about the music? I have to say, I think that's probably been seared into my musical memory since a child. I love that theme, that really stark, brassy, percussive theme at the beginning that represents the conspiracy and keeps coming back at dramatic moments. Love it.
Mm. I mean, Jerry Goldsmith again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Talk about reliable. Yeah, absolutely. He's got about 4 million credits on
Planet of the Apes, isn't it?
IMDb. I remember from I think The Omen was one of the ones. There was a little bit of piano at one point, sort of ominous sounding piano. I can't remember in the film. That reminded me of the piano from The Omen.
Okay, well, I said we'd come to this moment of talking about scenes and events in the film that we really loved and really hated. So what should we start with? Ones we really loved or ones we really hated?
I didn't hate any of it.
What, even the car bit?
Didn't hate it. It was silly.
Mm.
I mean, let's talk about stuff we found problems with first before we heap praise on it, shall we? I mean,
yeah. Go on then.
I'll ask some questions in the open discussion.
Okay.
Things I didn't understand about the film that perhaps I've missed a line of dialogue. The main thing is, so Capricorn 1, the rocket, went up. What happened to the rocket? Are we supposed to believe that it went to Mars and circled and came back, or did it just crash in the sea somewhere? So was everything that happened then completely faked? I know that they didn't go up, but what happened to the rocket? And then the other thing is the heat shield's not working and the character's dying. Now, was that in response to James Brolin's character? They think he's going to tell everyone what's happened. Or was that the rocket coming back and it was a genuine accident and they had to then kill the astronauts? I mean, it doesn't matter that it's not made clear, but I wondered whether anybody had any ideas on that.
I was going to ask you exactly the same thing. Did they deliberately bump them off? Yeah, I don't know.
I've got some ideas.
Go on then.
I just want to check. Frank, have you got any ideas about those things?
Yeah, I mean, probably it did go to Mars and back because they said that they skimped the on the life support, so they could have easily sent it there and back automatedly, I guess. That's my take on it. Automatic means or remote control. Then they'd at least have a plausible excuse for anybody on the ground observing, you know, for at least a short amount of time and be visible. As far as the heat shield failing, I think they had some suspicions that Brubaker, they're like, there's something not right with Brubaker. We're going to have to rub these guys out because we know he's going to spill the beans after this somehow.
Because I was thinking that, but then I was thinking of the whole point of the setup of the film is that they don't want to have any accidents because then that would jeopardize their funding. So then I was thinking, well, why have they done this? Because surely that will then jeopardize the funding. But then, of course, Hal Holbrook turns it into a thing where they say, well, these brave people sacrificed their lives. We've got to continue the program for their sake. Yes. So he kind of turned it. So I thought that was quite clever.
Exactly. Yes. Well, my theory about this is there are two levels to this. There's the Dr. Calloway level. He knows so much. But then he talks about there are people above me, kind of the powers that should not be. And I reckon that there's another level there where they actually do intend to get rid of these astronauts. Because, you know, when the heat shield fails, Dr. Calloway is clearly surprised by that. And at that moment, we've got the astronauts in the plane going to the drop zone. And then the plane turns round at that point. So on the Calloway level, I reckon they were expecting it to go according to the plan that he'd mentioned. But I think that above Calloway, there was never any intention for these astronauts to survive. And that, yeah, as long as they'd apparently gone to Mars, then the mission had been a success. Who cares about, you know, some, well, three heroes who die in the process? It was a successful mission.
The problem there, of course, is that if they planned this and they would have planned it ahead of time, they would have just crashed the plane with the astronauts in, wouldn't they? They wouldn't have let the astronauts manage to escape.
Oh, well, yeah, exactly, yeah.
And there was no real security there.
There's some weaknesses like that, sure.
No, I mean, there's just, you know, I mean, there are lots of those, aren't there? Okay, so now the other thing that, again, I thought this didn't make sense to me, but I thought originally Hal Holbrook says to the astronauts that we're going to take you off to this place. We're going to pretend that you landed on Mars. But NASA, the actual center, NASA Space Control, don't know about this. Now, did I misunderstand that? Because then, of course, when the analyst at NASA says there are problems, clearly the person he reports to clearly knows that there is a conspiracy and fobs him off. So was that something that I got wrong? Or are we supposed to believe that the whole of NASA, the top dogs at NASA, know about it as well? Or was it just like a splinter?
I think they were trying to make the point that far few people would need to know about something massive like that than the public might think.
Yes.
The thing you'll always find on kind of mainstream TV, everyone will just always make the same argument. Everyone would have to know, or why would one person not have talked? I think perhaps he's making the point that with sort of compartmentalization, someone would have to know, but there could be hundreds or even thousands. I don't know how many people NASA employ. The foot soldiers that wouldn't have a clue because they're just doing their part in the chain. So
I'm not sure
the plot totally worked, but I think that was the point I'm trying to make.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and then when somebody does get wind, as you say, this data analyst, so what's going on here? Yeah, this doesn't make sense. He's quickly ignored, and then he's wiped out. So, I mean, if you saw somebody who you'd been sitting next to suddenly disappear, would you, if you then had your own worries about it, would you think, oh, I'll go and tell about this as well? Or would you just keep your mouth shut? You know, there's an element of not only compartmentalization, but fear there too.
Right.
It's funny because I think the film works on that level. I think it's clever the way it sort of gaslights Elliot Gould's character and say, well, you never knew this person never lived at this house you've been to, etc. I think that's clever, that's very good. And yet sometimes it gets too on the nose at the beginning, where you've got Hal Holbrook delivering that speech, as you said, to the astronauts, and the astronauts are saying, well, we don't have to go along with this, and all he needed to say was, think of your families. But instead he goes on with, they're all in the plane, they're all together, there's a device on the plane, and it's just a bit on the nose, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree.
All you need to say is, just think of your families.
True.
But it's too overwritten for me.
Well, actually, that's interesting, because reportedly John Bolton, who was US National Security Advisor at one point, reportedly actually did say that to Jose Bustani. I think he was the first director of the OPCW, you know, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. And Bolton didn't want Bustani to stay in that position because Bustani wanted Iraq and Libya to be part of that organization, and that didn't fit with Bolton and his mate's agenda. So Bolton, this is according to Bustani, actually said to Bustani, we know where your children are. We know where your kids are. And they were at the time in America. And that's kind of all it was necessary to say. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like you know, strapped a bomb to your child or something. That's just a shame, because I thought the threat would have been better if it was left unsaid.
Yeah, because I think Julian, I'm sure on one of my previous appearances on TMR or sometime, maybe off mic, we said, you know, let's take Obama, because we talked a lot about Obama when he was president. The Bill Hicks idea of, you know, taking the president into a smoky room. He said it's a comedian. You know, all you'd have to say to Obama is, how are the kids? And look him in the eye with a slightly sinister look. That's all you need to say. You don't even need to say, oh, you know, we've got a device. Can I ask a question as well? What did the woman who was in the flat, what did she think?
What do we imagine she thought, you mean?
Yeah, what do we imagine she thought? She must have known that she hadn't been living there for a year.
Yeah, exactly. She must have been in on it, but she was just playing the part, wasn't she?
I guess she was a plant, and once that her job was done, that she would go back to her, you know, whatever she was doing before. That's what I took it to be.
Yeah, but then obviously she wouldn't know exactly why she was there, would she? They might just say, "Could you?"
I would say she was silly in on it because she's probably like a CIA asset or something.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
The same sort of thing happened in an episode of The Prisoner with Patrick McGoohan, where he actually gets back to his old flat in London, and there's some woman already living there, and like, basically, number six's whole existence had been erased, you know? Right. And the woman was there, and she's just totally like, no, I've lived here for years, you know? And so, and then it's revealed, like, she's really in on it. She's actually the number two for that episode, you know? And it's like, so I'm thinking something similar happened with this guy, if you erase the whole person like that. So she'd have to be like one of the people, I guess, quote unquote, in the village, you know.
Yeah, of course, the U.S. Postal Service would have to be involved, wouldn't it? Because he's looking at the magazine she subscribed to, and they've all got her address on it. But I like that. I like that. I think that works.
So couldn't there be some department that reproduces little tickets like that, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Julian, if you don't mind me mentioning Douglas Valentine, that you mentioned, the guy who wrote the book about the CIA, been researching it for 30 years. He said to me, the CIA has got such resources, you know, money and everything else, that they can just make things happen. You know, when you've got millions or billions of dollars or however much they've got, you can make things happen, and you can, there's ways and means of making it believable. You probably don't need to be killing lots of people. You just need to, I think bribery probably would play a huge part. Probably bribe that woman, who knows?
Well, they probably said to the woman, we know where your family is.
How's your family?
Yeah, I've always loved that scene. I mean, I didn't know the term gaslighting until, you know, recent years, but as a child, just the very idea that you could play with somebody's mind like that, just kind of rewrite history in front of somebody's face, was always intrigued me. I've never approved of it, but just the idea of doing it.
One thing in the script I like was that there's constant references to, like, it's mainly Calloway, isn't it, Hal Holbrook, about, like, oh, this is the dream. And if you question things, it's almost like you're kind of a party pooper, or you don't believe in the dream, you know? There's loads of references to that in the script, and that was interesting. It's a form of gaslighting, almost, to make you feel guilty or, like...
Yes.
You know? But it's more like the people in the office, you know? If you work in an office or something, you work with people, and you're that one kind of weirdo who questions things. You're very much ostracized. So I think it was good in the script. They had all those references to the dream. This is the dream. good stuff.
I guess that scene, which is excellent, unfortunately throws into harsh reality the other two scenes with Elliot Gould that are not good. The car scene, we already mentioned. I mean, the fact that they cut his brakes and also managed to make the car go faster and faster.
He goes at 100 miles an hour, doesn't he?
Oh, it's ridiculous.
He goes at 100 miles an hour in these narrow roads. It is quite ridiculous.
And he's able to turn corners sharply without the car going over. Anyway, so then he goes over the bridge. I mean, as a child, I thought, well, you know, seems reasonable. But you watch it as an adult, and that car's hitting the water at 100 miles an hour, whatever. He would have been either killed or severely paralysed. So then in the next scene, he's unhurt. He doesn't refer to it. You could have cut that out completely and it wouldn't have mattered. And then
it should have been.
I think so. And then, of course, the bit about the Western place, Flat Rock. Again, very clever. I like the way the husband says Yosemite. He could have said Flat Rock, but he says Yosemite, which then she questions. Then she mentions Flat Rock. And then Lady Eccle could have just said, oh, tell me more about that. Have you got any films? Yes. You don't need him to go to Flat Rock. And then... Somebody shoots him. I mean, somebody just takes a pot shot at him, and then you hear the car whiz off. Why don't they just shoot him dead? He's a sitting target if they were going to do that.
Absolutely.
It doesn't make any sense. He could have just cut that.
They should certainly have axed both of those, because I think that they're mutually inconsistent. You know, first of all, he's gaslighted by the friend no longer living.
Yeah.
And then they should have stuck with that theme of gaslighting. There's a bit of gaslight slightly with the cocaine incident.
Yeah.
But you can't go from gaslighting then to trying to kill him in the car. That makes no sense. No. And then trying to kill him or scare him off. Because, I mean, once you've scared him off with a shooting, you've undone the gaslighting, haven't you? You said, really are after you.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, those three are ridiculous. Yes. Yeah, totally agree.
Gaslighting is probably more effective because, like, if there is something strange like that going on and then someone questions it and you gaslight him, well, that automatically discredits him. I mean, you don't need to go after him and cut his car brakes and stuff.
No.
Can I just defend it very slightly?
Go on, then.
I just enjoy the way it evoked French Connection.
You
could always say it's a poor man's French Connection. I think this is the point where it's just sort of entertainment over this being a great film. I think this is a really good film, and I really enjoyed it last night. And I enjoyed that car bit, but I see,
it's a bit cheap looking.
Yeah, it's sort of cartoony almost, isn't it?
Yeah, which is kind of shame, isn't it? Really.
Yeah.
Can we still talk about one more thing that I didn't understand that you might throw some light on?
Sure.
Okay, so this is a mission to Mars. We have to assume that unlike the Apollo missions, they're not able to talk to the astronauts by video, even though they could on the Apollo, but for some reason, years afterwards, people can't talk to the astronauts inside by video. Okay. But then they land on Mars, and it's as if it's being recorded live at the time from their studio, and it's being fed into mission control because they're sort of getting, you know, slow motion now as he comes off the leg of the lander.
Yeah.
Why is that being done live? There's absolutely no reason. They've had weeks to prepare a film that they could have shown. Why risk making a live film for a start?
Yeah.
And then they say that's because there's a time lag, so we have to show you this. This is 20 minutes ago or something. But then before they return to Earth, they talk to their respective wives, and there's no time lag at all. And I've checked, and it says after this happens, somebody says, now we'll get you back home. So this isn't happening just before they land. This is happening while they're at Mars.
That doesn't follow, does it? Get you back home could mean we'll get you back through orbit, you know, out of orbit through the atmosphere.
Okay, possibly. But okay, we'll explain that bit about
I don't know
why they had to have a live feed from the studio instead of pre-recording it. That doesn't make any sense. That's opening themselves up to risk of accidentally filming the studio.
Tell you what I think.
What?
I reckon it is a weakness in terms of the plot, but I reckon it was done so that we could just see the actual action of the person jumping off the ladder onto the Martian surface, and at the same time watch it being transformed into slow motion, just for the sake of the audience to see that effect. That's what I reckon.
Yeah,
I think you're right. They've gone for entertainment over like a really solid, fully solid plot, I think.
Which is a weakness. It's fair enough, but I think that explains it.
It's a weakness in terms of it becoming an Oscar-winning film or anything like that, but I did find it very, very entertaining when I watched it last night.
Because it's an intelligent film, and I suppose that's what's annoying. It's intelligent, but they do some unintelligent things with it.
I think one of my favourite bits in the movie is, very intelligent part of the movie is where they're sort of recapitulating the President Nixon talking to the astronauts sort of thing. So you've got the recorded president's voice while they're filming the astronauts on the Martian surface, and the president is speaking with this recording, and then the camera is on one of the spaceman's helmets, you know, and then it goes back from there and you see more and more of the scene, and then you see two silhouetted mysterious figures standing to the left hand side, and the music goes into a really spooky atmosphere at that. I just absolutely love that. What I found weird about that is, you know, we've already had the TV set revealed to us, we already know that. That was pretty good as well. But it's like doing this again, but in that way, the deep irony of that with the president, you know, saying all these words and it all being revealed again is weirdly even more effective, you know, one of those hairs on the back of the neck moments.
Yeah, that's interesting because when I saw that, I thought, have they made a mistake and should that not have been the reveal? But you're sort of saying it's more effective to show it again.
It's difficult to judge, isn't it, how it would have been otherwise. I still love that moment. Yeah.
I think by then, to be honest, the audience would have known what was going on. So I suppose they did the right thing by making the audience know and then going for that. Because that exposes the hypocrisy of it, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Oh, what about this conspiracy meme of the black helicopters? That's a perfect choice, perfect choice. But they make the black helicopters almost like personalities in themselves, don't they?
Definitely, yeah.
they talk together in the air. That's how I've always thought about it.
Yeah.
Like big insects in the air talking to each other.
They look at each other and they, as if they're sort of, you know, exchanging expressions, and then they go back. Yeah. I don't know if they're models or not. They look incredibly close together.
They're real.
They are they?
They're real. There's a making of bit on the... Oh, okay. Yeah, they're real. They did a lot of work going back and forth trying to get those in the right position. Yeah, yeah, they are real.
Very, very effective.
Mm. Yeah, those last scenes are fantastic.
I really enjoyed that part. Yeah.
What film do we think of with crop duster planes?
Independence Day.
another one.
North by Northwest.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking in terms of sci-fi, it would be Independence Day, but North by Northwest. Yeah.
You see, now that's one of my bugbears. You talk about this, Mark. One of your bugbears. Well, in my case, it's machine guns again, because those helicopters had machine guns, and they were chasing this small plane, weren't they? And of course the small plane doesn't get hit. Well, what's the point in having machine guns in films? They're never any use. So you might as well have a pocket knife. It's always more use than a machine gun. Oh dear.
But that is just a trope that filmmakers just think they can get away with, even 2021, don't they?
I know. It's ridiculous.
We were just talking about the latest Bond film, which I couldn't take too seriously. Yeah. Again, like, you just got 10 people shooting at it, everything misses. Quite amazing. Yes,
plot armor.
Sorry?
They call that plot armor.
Plot armor, yeah.
That's what you got in all the Star Wars movies. All the main characters have plot armor. James Bond has plot armor. That's what they call it.
I always think to myself, well, what was a machine gun invented for, you know? Yeah. It was to kill people without aiming, wasn't it, basically? So, I don't know.
Not that that's funny, but yes.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
But my conspiracy theory is that they didn't want the film to be too good. In case it made people think too much. Let's put a few plot holes in, a few lines. Anyway,
So there's another level beyond the powers that should not be. Yeah, excellent.
I was going to say, I had in terms of conspiracy theory, that this film, if you really sit and think about it, it could serve as an anti-conspiracy theory. Like, no, we actually went because if we had faked it, this is what would have happened. We would have killed all the astronauts and see... they're still alive, so it couldn't have been fake. So like a reverse psychology is like, people point to this and, oh, it's proof that the moon landings are fake. I was like, no, you didn't watch the rest of the movie where they like had to kill everyone, you know?
And
because I mean, some reviewers have said this film, one of the themes of this film, or purposes of this film, is to show just how difficult it would be to pull something like this off. I don't know. On the other hand, had it not been for that accident, you know, maybe it could have been pulled off.
I think if they'd been less incompetent, they could have pulled it off, to be honest. Like keeping the astronauts under armed guard, for instance, would have been a possible...
Yes.
Would have helped, wouldn't it?
That would instead of one man who, when they do approach him, just does nothing and allows himself to be punched in the stomach.
Yeah.
I think the compartmentalization thing comes over pretty clearly, actually. Mm. We brought it up before, but I think that is a very important thing to bear in mind, that, you know, these conspiracies, ones that are successful, must operate in that way, that not everybody knows what's going on. Everybody has their little job to do and they don't see the whole picture. And we do see that happening in this. That was good. That's an important lesson, really.
I think also the 70s, there's a lot of anti-capitalism. I can't think of films off the top of my head, but there's obviously that element to it as well, isn't there? The fact that they skimped on the Mars mission, like I said, like they did in Towering Inferno. So there's a bit of that going on.
Right.
Just for the listeners, there's that documentary, The Corporation, Julia and I have talked about loads of times. And the idea that the corporation is a psychopath. They did a sort of psychiatric test on the corporation, not the people in it, but as a monolith kind of thing. There's a little bit of that as well, the sort of the faceless corporation or the faceless higher-ups that we literally don't see, do we? We just get Kellaway.
I quite like the fact that the three astronauts are sort of faceless. They're not, you know, Sidney Poitier and Laurence Olivier. They're just rather bland, ordinary people. I think that's more interesting.
They're kind of like the Apollo 11 3, aren't they?
It's only like Neil Armstrong, you know.
Great astronauts and all that, and very talented men, but they're not performers, are they?
They're not particularly characterful people, you get the impression, but why should they be, you know? And I think they've got chemistry, the three of them. I mean, they're not brilliant actors perhaps, but I believe them as a group of three people who've been together for a long time.
There's one thing that sort of disappoints me, but I don't know how you could have done it. Well, maybe you could have done it a different way, I don't know, but it kind of disappoints me at the end of the film. I'm going to say I think it preserves the myth, which I think is a myth, that the press is independent of the state, and through that, the truth will always come out. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, right at the end where Brubaker's running in slow motion, of course, towards his own memorial service. Yeah, all the TV cameras turn to look at it. And you know at that point, you know, the truth has come out. But, you know, I'm wondering if in reality, I can't hardly believe that would happen today. You know, I think they check with their producer first. And say, should I turn this camera or not? But even then, back then, because we're not talking about something, you know, on the level of party politics here. You know, we're talking about deep state stuff. Mm-hmm. Would they have felt that they have the freedom to basically overturn people's perception of the nation? You know, this is serious stuff. Am I going to move my camera and do that? Mm-hmm. I think that's a bit of a myth there.
I had a big problem with that last scene. I mean, the slow-mo and like the way they're smiling, like they're doing something heroic. I mean, they kind of are in a way. Mm. Seems like a very commercial, crowd-pleasing choice.
Yeah.
Can I just posit my questions, if you don't mind?
So, sure.
Yeah, what would have been the aftermath? In a sane world, if that had happened, let's imagine that happened in reality, that should change the world forever. Like the world should never be the same again. But I wonder, because the media are so good at presenting things in a slick way or spinning it, I wonder whether there'd be a way where the world wouldn't change. I don't know. Can you answer that for me? Because I'm very curious what you think.
Mm. Well, in what way would it change? Do you mean that people would then therefore question everything they've ever been told?
Yeah, basically. I mean, it's the smoking gun conspiracy. Mm. You know, obviously, not everybody is there. You know, the cameras do turn. But I'm sure there'd be a way where the higher-ups at the media organisation would find a way of spinning it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's this funny thing that no matter what happens, the world never quite changes, does it?
No.
You know what I mean?
I think what would have happened is they'd have pixelated out his face, they'd have kept Caulfield, and they'd have said Caulfield found some nutter to dress up as Brubaker and claim that, you know, the whole thing was a fake. True to form, you know.
I was thinking, this is a bit wild, but they could have even shot them, found a way of spinning that.
I mean, that was the president, wasn't it? Giving that was at the president at the funeral, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
that's right.
Okay, he wouldn't have got that close in reality anyway. But you're right, there would have been some kind of armed guard. There's a man running, two people running to the president. They would, as you say, they would have just shot them.
Yes.
And as they were running, so, as you said, they were running so slowly, they would have been very easy to shoot them.
You're right, the lack of protection there for the president was unbelievable,
It's going for a romantic ending, isn't it?
It is. And I think the fact that the president was there was good in the sense that that showed the cynicism of him turning up once the mission had been completed, you know, and the heroes had been revealed by their martyrdom. He could turn up for that. But of course, at the launch, he couldn't be bothered to be there because it might be politically dangerous for him, for being re-elected and all that sort of thing. Mm. I like that. I actually in some ways, I did like the ending. You know, with all its problems, because I think that, you know, when you see Kay's face, I think she did that really well. Mm. You know, she turns and she sees him and that look of surprise. But I see that as not just her surprise in, oh, my husband's still alive. And not even the whole thing was not as I thought it was. But it's kind of, you know, I think we were mentioning about a real awakening moment. I think that invites the audience to see in her face something bigger. You know, wow, you know, what else have we been lied to about? You know, this is a new world of realization happening here. But doesn't quite carry it somehow because of the other questions that I have about it, you know, the other misgivings about it, particularly to do with the press. It was a nice try. And
what
I like
flashed
it.
Through my mind, when they cut to Hal Holbrook, I was hoping like Hal Holbrook would have like a little smile. To sort of show that he didn't actually want Brubaker to be killed, he's the company man, he's got to do it. I thought that would have been a really good touch, but obviously it didn't happen.
Yes.
It's a shame, because that would have been, nice to have seen something.
Yeah, it was more a sort of, oh no, it's all over. That's what his face says to me anyway.
They should have put a caption at the end, gone black in the captions, saying Robert Caulfield and Charles, whatever his name was, were both killed in a crash the next day or something. That's what would happen. I mean, they'd both be taken to security, they'd fly off somewhere and they'd be killed. There would be an accident, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. That's what would happen.
Or again, they could have shot them. Everyone would have panicked. They could have taken the bodies away and they might be able to claim that it was imposters. I think one of you said that already, but
Or even what I was thinking is, you know, although the cameras turn, you know, that'd be like the moment they have a sudden, you know, communication electronics glitch and, you know, they would have cut out and be like, oh, there was technical difficulties, you know, and Elliot Gould or whoever he played, he hired this imposter. I think that's right along the track.
That's a good call, actually. Yeah, I think that's what they do.
I think so.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, we've reached that moment where I'm going to ask you what your individual takes are on the moon landings, whether you think they really happened or whether they, or whether they were hoaxes.
Right.
I have my own position on this, but won't start with me. Which of you would like to go first if you've really thought this through? What do you reckon?
I'll go first just because I don't have much, I don't have any opinion on it, to be honest. I've just never spent any time of it. I saw a thing with Marcus Allen, if you ever heard of him, talking about it with somebody. I think with a lot of these things, it's somewhere in the middle. Like they've probably faked some of the footage. I think it's been proved, actually, that one of the photos was actually a training photo. There's little things like that. Mm-hmm. But just to say, I honestly haven't spent hardly any time on it, so I wouldn't be able to say. Sorry for sitting on the fence.
No problem. I'm going to do the same. Frank, are you a fence sitter, or are you committed to one side or the other?
You know, I've been kind of on both sides of it. Obviously, seeing the original video they showed us when I was in elementary school, and I'm like, oh, wow, that's cool. And then, as I said earlier, I discovered Richard Hoagland's work. You know, I read most of his book about the hoax and everything. And I'm like, oh, it was totally all fake. But then since then, I've kind of, there was a guy, podcaster called Debunking Pseudo Astronomy or whatever. And he had a bunch of different ways he debunked the moon landing hoax. You know, like he said, okay, well, there's just tons of moon rocks that we've obtained that scientists actually study, you know. So that's proof that somebody went to the moon. And he had a few other blogs or podcasts where he went through all the different independent ways to prove that the moon landings happened. So I think I ended up coming away that I'm convinced that we did go there, but I, like Tony said, I'm probably kind of thinking that they did indeed fake some of the videos for it for some reason or another. And then you do have some of the dialogue, I think, was it Buzz or Neil, they were saying like, oh, wow, they're huge. Like they see something up there that's really huge and intimidating. It's like, well, what are they talking about? So I don't know. I do think the videos, maybe some of them are not authentic, but some of the photos. But, I do think we did go there.
That's "we" in inverted commas there, Frank.
Yeah.
I always think that when people say "we went to the moon," I think, well, I didn't go.
I was there. I was actually there. So.
Oh, yes. Forgot that. Sorry. Yeah.
I could just say one other thing. I think what annoys me nowadays is that, you know, you can say what you like about the internet, and obviously, you know, we're on it now, of course. But obviously, there's good information, there's bad information. But yeah. I think for someone in 2021 who's got their eyes open to just dismiss any idea that any of it could be faked, to still have that position in 2021, I find just unbelievable.
Yes.
You know, and I find it equally unbelievable people who sort of think everything is a conspiracy. You know, clearly, the truth is somewhere in the middle. But I think you've got to try and be open to these things. You know, you don't have to have a, you know, pro-vax, anti-vax, whatever. It just blows my mind that in 2021, and I can only put it down to people sort of still relying on mass media, which tends to simplify.
Yeah.
You know, like, I just find it amazing that there can only be two positions all the time. You know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I would even go so far as to say, you know, we probably have like a certain level of space program that's classified that we're not privy to as the public.
Could well be.
What that entails, I don't know, but perhaps maybe there have been people who've been to Mars, maybe not through a jump room, but through some sort of classified program or something, you know. I don't know, but I would say there's definitely segments of it that the public at large is not privy to, for sure.
I think I used to sort of believe it was faked because it was exciting to think it was faked, because it was sort of, you know, not the narrative that everyone else thinks. I'm better than you because I know something you don't, sort of thing. And when you look at the people who say they're faked, they have lots of all these points. You go, oh gosh, you know, all the shadows pointing in different directions, there's no stars, etc. And every single one of them can be explained quite reasonably scientifically. I mean, my three main reasons why I think it's not faked. If it was faked, Russia would blow the gaff. They would say, well, you faked it. And the second one, it was monitored to the moon and back by various independent countries. The film The Dish, Sam Neill, tells the story of Australia monitoring the Apollo missions to the moon and back. So these had nothing to do with NASA. They were independent and amateur people monitored it. So I kind of figured, well, probably happened. And then, of course, now you can bounce lasers. We have been able to bounce lasers off the equipment they left there on the moon. So how did that equipment get there? So I kind of think on the back, they went there. I mean, it was, I suppose the problem is it's such an extraordinary achievement. But you kind of think, well, it was so extraordinary that it can't have been possible. But I think it was actually incredibly extraordinary, and it did happen. And it only happened for, was it 12 people, something like that? And then the mission stopped. So it's not as if they kept going and going and going. So they did this one-off extraordinary thing. They proved they could do it. Obviously, yeah. The money and the interest ran out and it stopped. So I'm happy to believe that, actually. Mm. Yes. Mm. Whereas before, I think I didn't, just because I thought, oh, it's exciting to, you know, to think they didn't go. Yeah. Mm. And if anything, this film kind of backs up the fact they did go, because at the beginning, when Halbrook talks about the moon landings, he could have implied that there was an element that they were repeating, and he didn't. He sort of said, well, these happen. You know what yes. I mean? It's almost backing up the official narrative, I suppose.
Yes, he does speak of the moon landings as a thing that actually happened, doesn't he?
Mm.
Yeah.
Of course, it's interesting that they use absolutely identical Apollo capsule, don't they? They don't even make any effort whatsoever to make it look different.
Mm. Maybe that is to connote the Apollo missions and therefore to suggest that they were possibly fake.
Well, possibly, yes.
It's a nod to it, yeah, for sure.
I think it's a nod to it. I mean, it could be a cheap way of doing it. I think that they used a mock-up of that rather than having to create one of their own. But because I think the aerodynamics of landing on Mars is completely different to the moon, and you couldn't really land it. You had to have something that was more like a plane, I think, to land on Mars.
I'm just trying to find that quote. Yeah, this is Peter Higham's. It was said of him that he was covering the lunar landings and was pondering how easy it might be to fake the event due to the fact that there was only one eyewitness, namely the sole camera on the moon. So that was in his mind. Mm. So I think he was referencing the moon as part of the intrigue of the movie, isn't it, to ask the question. I wonder if those old moon landings were really not genuine, you see. So I think that was all deliberate to connote that.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, do you want to know my position on this?
Yeah, sure.
Well, I hadn't until recently seen, I mean, I've probably not even looked at the best source here, but it's one source that I came across, which is Bart Sibrel's Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon. And I presume you've all three seen that, have you?
No.
Famous documentary.
Years and years ago.
I have to
That's Bart Sibrel, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. So this is the guy who went round stalking Buzz Aldrin and Neil.
Yeah, he got punched Armstrong. By Buzz Aldrin.
Oh, okay, he's the guy who got punched, right?
He did, he got punched, that's right. Because he wanted them to swear on the Bible that they'd been to the moon, and they weren't interested. So yeah, I saw the documentary and, you know, with the best will in the world, again, this is probably a bad source, but I thought every argument, nearly every argument he came up with, just clearly not convincing. As you say, Mark, had another explanation easily to be found.
Right.
You know, the kind of Gish Gallop thing of just going as quickly as you can through the text so that people can't process, you know, what's being said. So I wasn't at all impressed by that. But I mean, to be quite honest, over the years, I've not really, I think somebody else said this, it's not a thing that's come up on my radar, sorry about the pun there, as something to look into, because although a lot of people won't believe what I'm about to say, it is the case that I don't actually go looking for conspiracy theories. Mm. It's more the other way around. You know, if something hits me in the face as an insult to me, I think, you've got to be kidding, that can't be true. Then, of course, I want to find out more about it. But this has never really hit me as something like that. I did watch a documentary last year, I think it was on mainstream media. It was, you know, it was a nice, slick documentary about the moon landings. And I felt they were so falling over themselves to convince us it really did happen. It actually left me thinking, you know, I'm not sure I could believe that people did go. On the other hand, I can't believe they didn't go. So I was weirdly left in this twilight zone of thinking 50-50 about it. So I now jokingly say I'm 51% sure we went and 49% sure we didn't go.
You should say 51 or 59.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Try and leave that in.
Has anybody seen a film called Apollo 18?
No.
Which is a horror film.
No, I've seen Apollo 13.
All right, Apollo 18 is the mission that they never told you about.
Oh, no.
It's a found footage film. It's a horror film. Quite good, actually. But there's basically the moon soil is, I think, sentient.
Ooh.
These strange rock creatures. But it's why they never went back to the moon, because there's some aliens up there.
I did want to mention one thing that you may have seen, which does give me pause, and that is the admittedly very awkward post-flight press conference by the three of them, where particularly Neil Armstrong looks incredibly uncomfortable. You know, I do get the impression from that there was something was up. But of course, I don't know what. I don't think that proves, you know, the hoax theory, but certainly consistent with it and is suspicious. And it's so different from a pre-flight press conference that I saw, because I thought I would check. You know, what were they like beforehand? Were they, you know, they still had their mannerisms, but they were clearly more relaxed. And I thought, well, you know, really it should be the way around. You know, before they go on this flight, they should be all uptight about it. And then afterwards, be relaxed. But no, it was the other way around. So that does give me pause. But that's all it does, you know.
I mean, how long were they in isolation for afterwards? Was it a month?
Oh,
I think they came back to the Earth and they were kept in a box for about a month, I think.
Mm.
Just the three of them.
Mm.
I just wonder what that would have done to their minds.
Yeah. Good point.
And I know it was quite rushed, wasn't it? The first moon landing, they only had less than a day up there or something. It was very much to make a point. They didn't really do much in the way of scientific experiments. Perhaps he was a bit miffed about that. I don't know. But. Mm.
Another thing I thought about this is, why would you do more than one hoax? You know, if Apollo 11 was hoaxed, why would you do, is it six more?
Yeah.
You know, you've achieved your PR objective, so why jeopardize that by trying to do more fakes?
Yeah.
Maybe you could argue 11 was faked and the rest were real. The 11 was just there to, you know, just say, hey, we were here first. And
you have to pick fake.
Kind of joking.
Faked and,
that would be a theory. Because they wanted to beat the Russians, maybe they weren't quite ready in 1969.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying
that. That'd be the only argument I could see.
That's what I've heard as well. But then wouldn't Russia do its best to point out the truth of it then?
Exactly. Yeah. So,
or on the other hand, why wouldn't Russia just do their own fake?
Well, they did, didn't they? Well, they'd point out America was faked, and then they'd do their own fake, but they would say theirs was real, wouldn't they?
It's quite funny. It's quite funny, though, isn't it? Certainly in the British media, that they'll laugh at all conspiracy theories, but when they're Russian ones, everyone's like, "Oh yeah, yeah, of course."
Yeah, yeah.
No, absolutely. Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's perfectly believable, and I'm sure that works the other way. Obviously. You know?
Oh yeah, yeah. Mm. That's really interesting.
I mean, So going back to what I was saying that before, they were in there for 3 weeks in this little camper van size thing together. So perhaps they were just, you know, they lost the edge, had completely come off what they'd done.
Mm.
I haven't seen the press briefing, so I don't know, but. Perhaps that played a part.
Mm. Well, watch it. It's very interesting.
Okay, well,
It is. It does put a question in one's mind.
Mm,
So what I will say is that I don't dismiss the notion outright, you know. I'm just not yet persuaded, but, you know, I've not looked into it enough, I suppose. I'm not that bothered to look into it because I'm not convinced it's that important. But I don't think it's unthinkable, and I certainly wouldn't, you know, wish to criticise anybody for having serious doubts about it. I can understand why people would. We should think about these things, that's for sure. But I'm not persuaded or think it's important enough to spend a huge amount of time on.
Then it becomes more of a kind of a psychological thing almost, doesn't it? You know, you can't prove it either way, but it's about being open and being, I would say, not being naive enough to think that nothing goes on behind the scenes. I mean, that's just ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just echo what you said, Julie. I'm not looking for conspiracies to make my life more exciting.
Yeah.
You know? It's just, you know, it's being open to information and not being afraid of it.
It is.
You don't have to sit in a darkened room getting depressed about it. But I think being open to it is quite important.
Yeah, and I don't think one necessarily needs to reach a conclusion. I mean, I jokingly said about the 51% and 49% to get it right this time. But actually, you know, I'd probably say it's more like, well, you know, 75% we went, 25% maybe we didn't. And that is we in inverted commas. I'm happy to live with that. You know, I think it's not impossible. It's not impossible. I think it's very unlikely that it was hoaxed, you know. So I can live with that. Oh, there was one interesting thing I came across. I don't know what to make of this. There's a little, tiny little video of Buzz Aldrin talking to a small girl, and he seems to say they didn't go. I don't know what to make of that.
What?
Wow.
But, you know.
I like the way you just kept that after 2 hours.
You just dropped that in.
But quite what's going on in his mind, whether he's sober or whatever, I have no idea.
You know, I talked to a guy about Buzz Aldrin once because I think I brought up the Freemason connection with him, which supposedly Buzz Aldrin is, and I think he is. But and this guy I talked to, he was a much lower level Mason, you know. I'm like, well, what about Buzz Aldrin? He's got to know all the secret stuff. He's like, oh, that Buzz. I came away with the feeling like, oh, yeah, that Buzz Aldrin. He's always pulling people's legs or like, you know, like, oh, that Buzz, you know.
This is an interesting character, isn't he? I'm according to a documentary I saw recently, a sort of docudrama thing where they were using the audio tapes of the mission, but it was acted. It was well done. A bit too long, but it was well done. And they said there that he was perhaps the brightest of them. Well, they're all bright, of course, but perhaps the brightest of the three, and also the most religious of the three, apparently took some bread from communion up there, shared communion, you know, with his home church kind of thing.
I heard too.
And yet there are these strange things about him. I mean, I also saw another interview with him. This is many, many years later, you know, as an elderly man, where he's confronted with supposed evidence. I'm not sure. I think it's a Sybil-like evidence. I wasn't convinced by it. But anyway, his reaction to that was very odd. It wasn't like, oh, what a lot of nonsense. It was kind of, it was really, really defensive. And I thought, why are you reacting like this? You know, so there are strange things about the way he behaves, you know. Oh, well.
Yeah, he definitely behaves strangely depending on the situation he's in. Like, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he'll tell the girl, yeah, we never went, and punch Bart Sybil in the face, you know, for challenging him. Like, well, you know. Pick one, Buzz. You know.
He is interesting. He's an interesting character.
Yeah.
Isn't it you, Frank, that believes that this was all filmed by Stanley Kubrick on the moon? Is that right?
Oh. There's a joke on the internet where it said, yes, the moon landings were fake and they were filmed by Stanley Kubrick, but he's such a stickler for details, he actually filmed it on location. So he filmed the on the moon.
Yeah. I think it's quite a good straw man, though, isn't it? That's quite a good straw man. They just make it sound so ridiculous.
Oh, sure, sure, yeah. I was only bringing it up as a segue, actually.
Mm.
What do you reckon to the idea that he might have been involved? Because there is that thing in The Shining, isn't there?
Yeah.
Where the little kid has Apollo 11 on his jumper.
Oh, yeah.
Is he putting clues into his films?
Mm.
Have any of you ever heard of Rob Agar?
Yes.
He does film analysis. I've actually become a friend of his over the last few years. Mm. He's pretty much debunked the Apollo 11 thing from The Shining.
Uh-huh.
Not say he's right, but I'm just saying he's very into looking for these things that could be true.
Mm.
He's done loads of, been to the Kubrick archives. He just said one thing to me when I went to visit him in Liverpool. We were in a pub. He said Kubrick knew a lot. That's all he said, you know. Because there's stuff in Dr. Strangelove.
Yes.
It's so accurate that I think a lot of the, you said the powers that shouldn't be, whatever you want to call them, they were looking at it going, oh, well, hang on a minute, how did he know that?
Ooh, we got a little kid with us here.
Yeah, we've got a little kid, yes.
Is it Oscar?
Coming in on the moon landings.
Yeah, Oscar, what she thinks of the moon landings.
Oscar, say daddy. Say daddy. No, off you guys. You still there?
Oh, where were we up to? Yeah, I lost track of where we were up to. What did we say?
Sorry.
Kubrick.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You were saying about Kubrick seemed to be privy to information. Wasn't there something about...
Yeah.
I think James Corbett talked about this once, that he had information about B-52 bombers that he shouldn't have had access to.
I think that's the thing from Dr. Strangelove, yeah.
That's right. And the detail inside the cockpit was astonishing. And people were rather worried that he might get into trouble for that. I think he might have been worried himself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he's just one of these people who... clearly knew about the deep state, I think. And in those days, there can't have been too many people, because as Peter Hyams said, you know, you just got your newspaper and watched the TV and people more or less believed it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he was quite singular there. I mean, Kubrick did a lot of reading, we know that.
Yeah.
His final film, even the Eyes Wide Shut, that actually someone had said that there was a bunch of it that had been cut that was never released, and that stuff was supposedly too on the nose. And even with what was released, is like he was like outing people through their masks in the movies and stuff, and like just basically outing the whole culture where they're doing these weird secret things, you know. Mm. He died of a heart attack not too long after the movie was released.
Yeah.
It's very annoying. I nearly met him. It's very annoying because I got friendly with his personal assistant, Tony Fruin. And he wrote some crime books. I interviewed him and had a nice long chat to him. And I was hoping, just to possibly meet Kubrick. And then he went and died. Yeah. So that was... I went to his house. I mean, I've gone to his house, and there's an art exhibition by his wife, and so I met his wife and his daughter. His daughter was in 2001.
So they were doing the Skype video call.
Really cool, actually. But it would just be nice on the Cape to have met him, see what he was like in person.
Yes, it would have been. A shame. And his wife apparently was in a mockumentary, which I've not seen, about the possibility of him being involved in filming the moon landing.
Wasn't
that the one where they took they were talking about something else?
Yeah, that's right. They had
all real clips of Rumsfeld and everyone.
They have clips of Donald Rumsfeld and Henry Kissinger speaking about other things, but it's mixed in such a way that it looks like they were talking about, and they, you know, supposedly went to Kubrick to get him to film the landings at the MGM studios in the UK over a quiet weekend with some CIA people playing the astronauts. It's a mockumentary. So, yeah. You know, but she was involved in it, apparently.
The thing is, you know, I'm sure we've all seen hundreds of sci-fi movies made in that time, and none of the effects come anywhere near the shots from the Apollo missions. They're completely different, aren't they, in terms of quality? There's no way they could have faked.
Even 2001?
Yeah. I mean, 2001 is excellent, but you can see their effects.
But how do you explain the jumper, then, in The Shining? It's got Apollo 11 on it.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, moon landings are faked. Right. Not at all that a boy of that age would be interested in the Apollo moon landings, obviously. But no.
Yeah. But not only that, he rises from a hexagonal shaped carpet. Now, like the launch pad.
Yeah, it does. That does look like the launch pad, yeah.
That's right. It's a launch, isn't it? And then he moves from one place to another and he goes to room 237.
Oh, the hexagon.
And it was supposed to be 237,000 miles, allegedly, at the time. It was believed, you know, that was the average distance between the Earth and the Moon and all that. So
I'm
convinced.
Yeah, also, the hexagons change from shop to shop, don't they? From the shop facing him to the shop from his back, they've changed the pattern of the carpet.
Kubrick has lots of continuity errors in his films. Again, Rob Eggers was talking about this, said he's so meticulous that he thinks so many of them were deliberate.
Oh.
They don't necessarily mean anything. The typewriter disappears during The Shining. There's loads of them, actually.
Well, the idea that when he's interviewed by the guy in the office, and it's only pointed out to me after I've watched this 17 times, that, you know, you see the window of his office showing outside, but actually the office is right in the middle of the building. You know, it doesn't make any sense.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. So do you think he does stuff then to play with us?
Oh, definitely.
So he may have wanted us perhaps to question, was he involved in faking the moon landings when he wasn't? Okay, I think we're going to have to draw to a conclusion here because, you know, obviously you've got to get to your little boy there. So anyway, thank you ever so much. So thank you ever so much, you three, for coming on to talk about this fascinating film. Great entertainment, but it does throw up lots of questions which we've been able to talk about. So it's been great and enjoyed it very much. Thanks very much, all of you, for coming on. And Oscar.
You've got to have a bath, haven't you, Oscar? Yes.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank
great.
You.
Yes. You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Julian.
Thanks, Jules.
Yay. Telescope cracks, I moves back and forth as we make our way on.